It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about the war in Ukraine, financial sustainability, and a new code of practice on admissions. It's all coming up.
I need to be careful because I don't want to be the old man who had his say 3 years ago and is now sort of standing in the background carping about things that are there and things that aren't there. But it would be good if the public finances permitted maintenance grants at some point to come back in. I think a step has been made, a gesture has been, more than a gesture, a 75 million fund, speaking from memory.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me are three brilliant guests as usual to help unpack the week's goings-on in HE. In his house in Nottingham, it's Registrar of the University of Nottingham, Paul Greatrix, and friend of the show. Paul, your highlight of the week, please.
Obviously the week hasn't finished yet, but my highlight has been pressing the button on the OFS consultation draft submission earlier this week. That was fun.
And in Dunstable, it's Laura Tamara, co-president of the Students' Union at the University of Bedfordshire. Laura, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is campaigning to keep my job as a female co-president at BEDS-SU. So I've been in the face of many students asking for their support. Voting closes today at 4 o'clock, and so it's a very tense time for me at the moment.
Well, you've got the wonky vote, so good luck.
Thank you.
And from DigiFest in Birmingham, it's Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan. Or DK to you and me. DK, your highlight of the week.
People that know me well would know I'm a huge fan of a journalist named Audrey Waters, and it was a delight for me to hear her speak on the topic of hope in these dark times at DigiFest.
We start the week with the disaster that is the war in Ukraine and the fallout on the higher education community around the world.
Well, it's an incredibly disturbing and worrying situation in Ukraine for all of us. It's headlines on the news. It's a deeply unsettling and anxious period for everyone, not least those Ukrainian residents fearing for their lives in the teeth of a Russian invasion. It's incredibly difficult for all of us to process what's going on, and everyone in the UK, I think, wants to do the right thing, and everyone in higher education is looking for ways in which we can help and offer support and ensure that we are doing all that we can to support academics and students in the Ukraine, but also anyone fleeing that country and looking for a safe haven in the rest of Europe. So it is just an incredibly difficult situation. And universities and staff in universities and students in universities are all grappling with ways in which we can try and provide the right level of support for our colleagues and friends in Ukraine. And it's incredibly difficult because we all want to do something. We all want to help in whatever way we can. And yet, part of the challenge, I think, for us is that we can, and indeed we've seen this, and it's right and proper that universities and our representative bodies, Universities UK and other sector agencies and learned bodies, etc., make very, very strong and very clear declarations of intent around this, condemning the invasion, condemning the behaviour of Russia on this, and looking at all the links we have and trying to find ways to demonstrate our disapproval through whatever means we can. However, these are, you know, gestures at heart. And what we all want to do, I think, is to do things that actually matter and will make a difference. And that's where I think we're all struggling because, you know, government is talking grand words and delivering what seems like, you know, precious little on the ground, particularly in terms of refugees and access to our country in a way that I think the British population wants. But universities want to do more. Students want to do more. Staff want to do more. So we're all, I think, grappling with how to do better. And there are things we can do. There is an agency called the Campaign for At-Risk Academics, Council for At-Risk Academics, which provides a structured support and exit package for academics who are escaping crises like these. But the scale of this is bigger than anything I think they've ever coped with. So Universities UK, I know, is trying to convene support. Universities are all trying to do their own thing. We want to welcome staff. We want to support them. We want to welcome students. We want to support them. Our visa regime doesn't make it helpful. But I think we all want to do do the very best we can, but it's incredibly difficult. And I think, you know, we're all looking for ideas and ways to help, but it just remains an incredibly challenging situation and heartbreaking, actually. And I've never seen anything like it in my career, and I hope I never do again, but we all want to do the right thing, I think.
The Council for At-Risk Academics is a brilliant program. I'll put a link in the show notes. It makes me think that, you know, a kind of Council for At-Risk Students, charity would probably be welcome. Caroline Noakes, from the Women Equality Select Committee proposed something similar, saying, you know, maybe we could have some kind of national program for students to come and take up places at UK universities. I mean, enormously difficult to do something like that, but I mean,
it would require changes to the visa regime, which would require the Home Office to change its position, right? At the moment, the way in which universities are required to process Tier 4 visas for students would mean that it would be incredibly difficult simply to admit someone, a student studying in the Ukraine at the moment, who's no longer able to study because their university's been bombed, to do that simply and clearly. It would require the Home Office to change the visa regime. I think they should. I think we would find ways to welcome them and support those students quickly and rapidly. And every university in the country would want to do that.
Laura, I'm interested to know. I mean, you're currently campaigning in a cross-campus election. I'm interested to know what students are saying about this issue and what they're asking of the Students' Union and what you're asking of the university.
Well, we were quite quickly inundated with requests to comment on the situation, which we did, but we always try to keep in step with our university and sort of not be too far away from what the university is saying. The Vice Chancellor was very prompt to also condemn what was happening and to offer support to students who feel that they needed it in the way of chaplaincy, counselling, and just showing a togetherness in the student community. Also yesterday, we received communication that they're being inundated with donations, so much so that they can't actually receive everything anymore and get it off the ground. So we're now being directed to give financial support and have been given reputable charities to donate to show support that way.
I think that is a really important point about the support that we're looking to provide to Ukrainian as well as Russian students and staff, because it's an incredibly difficult and anxious time for them as well. And there are many Russians and Ukrainians in the UK, and it is difficult for them.
Mm. I mean, TK, one of the other issues this kind of exposes, one of the fault lines, is this question about sanctions and kind of boycotts of universities in Russia. I mean, someone saying this week, you know, universities don't boycott other universities. You know, that's generally not how things have done. But there is a kind of isolation of Russia that's emerging that kind of crosses all kind of economic, social, educational boundaries, and that's new, and that's a problem, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, there's been a number of things that have concerned me on this. I mean, the real shock for me was the statement by the Russian Union of Rectors. That's approximately the equivalent of a Russian version of Universities UK. It's a grouping of institutional leaders, vice chancellors, and they made a statement strongly in support of the war, strongly in support of Vladimir Putin's actions. And that, I mean, that just felt to me as that is not a thing that should be happening in academia, not a thing that should be happening in higher education. The European universities groups have been quick to distance themselves from those particular universities. And there's also a general expectation that in considering existing and new collaborations with universities and agencies in Russia, the message in European terms and also echoed by Universities UK is that these should be considered very, very carefully, that there should be no collaborations or we're working together with Russian state actors, and we should be really careful about the universities that we are working with in Russia. It is a difficult balance. Obviously, the temptation is to try and do everything we possibly can to help the people of Ukraine, the academics and students in Ukraine, and as part of a sector which is global by definition, is built on connection between staff and students in different countries. This is a very, very difficult line to walk, I think.
Mm. I mean, I read that the statement by the Russian Union of Rectors. It's kind of hard to read because it reads to me like, so you know, someone writing something with essentially a kind of gun to their head. You know, we rolled a rally around the president, and the events taking place excite every citizen of Russia, and kind of, you know, making it sound like the idea behind the university system there is to support, it was instill patriotism, kind of almost beyond, you know, deliver higher education. I mean, that sounds to me like, you know, people who have to say that for fear of perhaps their lives, for fear of their freedom, and everything else. So it's very hard to know, isn't it? And where do we draw that line?
I think it is genuinely frightening, and it does highlight the fact that, you know, these are effectively state-directed organizations, and I think that's where the break has to happen. But you know that there are thousands, many thousands of progressive academics within Russia who will equally be appalled by this. And it's important that we don't simply cut off all links with those progressive forces in Russia, because there'll be lots of really strong individual relationships.
Yeah, presumably lots of active research collaborations going on, presumably things that are live that can't just be stopped between all kinds of different universities, you would have thought.
Yeah, we have to be careful, though, because some of them may be deemed to be actually security sensitive, and ones that you would have to stop. But those individual personal relationships, which are so important to successful research, are ones that I think it would be deeply, deeply sad and indeed wrong to prevent from occurring in future, because actually that's where the change will happen after all this has ultimately been resolved. And we look to move forward with a move in the long run to a different kind of Russia.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi there. I've written a blog for 1KG talking about the academic other in university administrations. My name is Muriel. I work for the Open University as a senior management professional as well as a research affiliate in the music department. I suggest in my blog that academically employed staff and research management professionals in fact have more in common than sometimes they would like to think. Both groups care deeply about the quality of research and teaching that happens at our institutions, and indeed also about the knowledge sharing that goes on through them and by them. However, through our internal squabbles, and because we don't necessarily see each other as supporting the same functions, we are doing ourselves a disservice. I suggest in my blog, therefore, that perhaps if we took the time to acknowledge our similarities rather than focus on the differences, we could support the great initiatives that go on at institutions even better still, and dare I say it, perhaps even review a few contracts along the way.
Now, earlier in the week, we held our new rules event, where we unpacked the post-Auga political and funding settlement for universities, and our first big guest was Philip Auga himself. I started by asking him what he thought of the government's response to his review.
General perception I have is that the reaction to the government's proposals is pretty much consistent with the direction of UK tertiary education policy for about 50 years, which was an excessive concentration on the HE elements and a tendency to completely wash over what I think is the truly transformative bit, which is the lifelong learning entitlement, how that can reboot further education and reboot the life opportunities for still the vast majority of the population who don't have a degree, and the 50% or so of young people even now who don't go to university. So there has been quite a lot done by the government since our first report. The Skills for Jobs white paper, I thought, was important. The skills bill going through Parliament at the moment is really, really significant. I particularly like the connection between the sector employers and through the skills improvement plans. This is really important stuff. But actually, and it's quite difficult to make the connection, but actually, if you think through the lifelong learning entitlement, that's actually how you do it. That's how you get FE rebooted. There's certainly more to be done in terms of remuneration for staff, training for staff, CapEx, fees, all the rest of it. But the lifelong learning entitlement, the extension of maintenance to part-time, the extension of maintenance to what are currently called non-designated level four, level fives. This is actually it's there. It's a lot already in the pipeline. Why doesn't it get more attention? Well, partly because it's a complicated story to tell. Partly because I suppose the people that write the comment tend to be graduates themselves and to have children who they want to be graduates. Partly because the HE sector is incredibly important to this country. One thing the panel was quite clear to make clear was our support for the sector right up front. We understand the terrific cultural, social and economic work that the HE sector does. So there's that. It's also that, there is no, as far as I know, Wonk FE, is there? There is no, there are no think tanks dedicated to further education. And in fact, if there's anyone out there listening to this who'd be interested in talking to me about setting up a further education policy institute, for example, my website is philiborger.com. You can leave me a message there, and it's something I want to have a look at over the coming weeks and months. So it's
I agree. It's much needed. We talk about that. We talk about that point quite a lot, actually. Fascinating. Anyone, and genuinely, please loop us in as well. We're fascinated to be part of that conversation. I want to talk about one of the things that wasn't there, just because it was so conspicuous. The whole of Chapter 7 about student maintenance, and you know, understandably, a lot of the commentary and debate has been about that point since the launch, because it does feel like a huge missing piece of the puzzle.
I need to be careful because I don't want to be the old man who had his say 3 years ago and is now standing in the background carping about things that are there and things that aren't there. But it would be good if the public finances permitted maintenance grants at some point to come back in. I think it's a step has been made. A gesture has been more than a gesture, a 75 million fund, speaking from memory. This is something I hope we can come back to look at in future. When we constructed the recommendations, as Debbie said, there are quite a lot, too many to list. I think there are 50 odd. We said to government, and probably we said in print, this is an integrated package. Please don't unpick part. Don't just take parts of it. It's the whole thing. I suppose realistically, we never expected that to happen, but it all fits in. It's like a jigsaw puzzle.
Now, the National Audit Office has been digging into the financial sustainability of universities. DK, talk us through it.
So this is a National Audit Office value for money report. What they do is they look at all kinds of public spending and regulation on behalf of the public purse, and they see how well it's working, and they make recommendations as to how it could be improved. They happen to turn to the financial stability of higher education institutions in 2020-21, which was kind of a landmark year for thinking about financial sustainability of universities. We learn from the report that there are 10 providers that are currently facing enhanced monitoring from the Office for Students on the grounds of financial instability. We learned that a small number of providers did approach the DfE regime for restructuring during the pandemic, and that 3 actually entered that regime. And we learned that there were and remain concerns about the liquidity of universities and other higher education providers. there was 33 out of 247 during 2020-21 that said they did not have enough liquidity to cover 30 days of expenses, which is like the absolute baseline of financial stability. It just basically means if you don't get any more money, you can still pay wages and other costs that month. But the purpose of this report is not just to think about the actual universities themselves, also the regulation. The report notes that the OFS is a newish regulator. It's making decent use of the financial data, but it's not particularly good at communicating with the sector and bringing the sector along with it. And that, to me, in the face of the numerous ongoing consultations that are being run by the OFS and some of the slightly surprising messages in the Augur response and related things, makes me think that we are turning towards a period of government scrutiny of the Office for Students. We talked on the site last week about the possibility of post-legislative scrutiny of the Higher Education and Research Act. We also are reminded from this report that we are pending a tailored report that's conducted by the DfE on the success or otherwise of the Office for Students, coming at a time when the Office for Students is searching for a new chief executive. It is a very interesting moment in regulation in England.
So there's a lot here. I mean, Paul, does the OFS, can the OFS do anything differently to what Hefke did when it looked at financial sustainability of universities? So we've got 10 providers under enhanced monitoring, which is kind of a technical phrase. But I mean, you know, Hefke could always tell whether a university was in financial trouble, right?
Yeah, and I think the starting point for Hefke and the starting point for the OFS are very different, in that, you know, Hefke saw itself as having a role to try and identify these problems as early as it could, and then to ensure that the right steps were taken very quietly, but very appropriately, to make the necessary changes to support people, institutions through those difficulties, always trying to keep it, as low key as possible to avoid, you know, spooking everyone quite reasonably. The OFS, you know, and I'm not criticizing the OFS for this, but, you know, personally, I think that the premise isn't the right one. Its brief is an entirely different one. Its brief is to be a regulator and to treat, you know, without fear or favour, the institutions within its brief in the interests of students, right? Now, you can debate whether or not it's acted in the interest of students, but it does not see itself at all, as Hefke did, as having a responsibility for maintaining the sector, right? So there is a sense in which if one or two universities completely collapse financially, that's unfortunate from an OFS perspective, but, you know, arrangements will be in place to deal with that. Hefke would have regarded that as, you know, something of an existential crisis for higher education in the UK and would have done everything in its power, drawing on other resources within the sector to ensure that that didn't happen. And it didn't happen on Hefke's watch. We've always had predictions of universities going to the wall. It's never happened. And I think that in its limited lifespan, you know, OFS has certainly sought to ensure that that doesn't happen. But it's, I have to say, I think it's a bit more, dispassionate, about the success or otherwise of higher education in the UK than Hefke was. And I think that if I were in one of those, 10 universities, I'm not, but if I were, I would be even more anxious now than I would have been in the past. But there is much more of this on the way. This is the direction of travel. And I think, you know, potentially the OFS does need to look at this more in the round than on a case by case basis.
No, I'm interested in kind of, you know, the extent to which you feel that you understand the kind of financial situation of your university, and you know, do you feel like that, you know, do you feel well briefed and informed? And when I assume you go along to governing body meetings, you know, do you know, is there open discussion about these sorts of things? Because previously some of these things have been not exactly hushed up, but it's been less than transparent in some cases, and I think that's led to some financial problems in some universities.
Agreed. I'm very much at the table in the room when these discussions are being had. I have access as a governor to, I'm privy to all of the financial information. I don't doubt that there are conversations that I am not privy to. However, for the purpose of transparency, I believe that my university is compliant and they are sharing with me the position financially of the institution.
So the other arm of this report, of course, is directly concerned with students and the student experience. Finding number 18 is the OFS lacks a strong measure with which to judge the value for money that students get from their courses. And we saw the impact of that in the concerns around the quality of provision during the lockdown phases of the pandemic and the idea that students could complain if they weren't getting adequate teaching and resources, but they were never told what adequate actually was or what that should mean. Now, the Office for Students, I think, has rightly shied away from a single metric or a compound metric even on the quality of teaching and learning as it pertains to the value for money for a degree. HEPI and the Advanced HE, obviously they have their survey that does look at value for money, and they saw that dip in the survey during and relating to the lockdown phases of the pandemic. The official regulatory position is that it means different things to different people, and it will change for those people over time. But the consequences of choosing to regulate in the way that the OFS has been designed and had conducted itself during its life is that we lose an aspect of students having an understanding of what they should actually be able to expect from their provider, what they can reasonably ask for, and of the regulator having a more direct line into what is actually happening in the Zoom classroom or on VLE. So that, again, will be something else that the Office for Students will be looking at very, very carefully.
I mean, and the other thing though, Paul, is that, I mean, you know, we've been talking on the show for years, and people are constantly ask us, you know, are there universities that are about to fall over in some shape or form, and that hasn't yet happened. And although there's obviously some liquidity problems in a bunch of providers, I guess this kind of confirms that we're not staring down the barrel of a, you know, widespread institutional failure.
Not yet. But if you look at what's coming down the track, right now, I'm a bit of a Cassandra on this, I must admit. But you look at what's coming in terms of the inflationary pressures hitting universities. And I know, you know, we've still got ongoing disputes in parts of the sector around pensions and around pay. You know, the additional costs for institutions there are still significant. And the other costs around energy prices, around other things that we're all hearing about in terms of cost of living, will have a profound effect on the cost base of universities as well. So will affect an awful lot more institutions. So I think we're in for some real financial challenge ahead. The Treasury and indeed other parts of government still have this perception that somehow universities are awash with cash. It really isn't the case. There are parts of the sector who have historically very strong reserves thanks to their 800 years of land ownership and privilege. But there are other parts of the sector who are very, very far from that. But I do think, going back to the regulatory argument, right, you know, I am yet to see any piece of the regulatory architecture which has actually demonstrably enhanced the student experience in a classroom, right? And the more and more regulation we layer on top of this, right, the further and further we're going to get from actually improving that experience as well, and the more costly and interventionist and unhelpful and distracting that regulatory architecture is going to be. I have a personal beef about this, as you know, but nevertheless, I have yet, I think, I would argue, to be proved wrong.
If I may, an area that I would say is a big liability for us is halls of residence. We have so many empty rooms at our Luton campus, and we're desperate for students to come and, you know, have the full student experience, live in Luton and study in Luton. But many of the international students we have choose to live outside of the town, which is a real disappointment. And that's something that I know our Vice Chancellor is really working on, to get that appeal to the student who wants to spend time on campus and actually live on campus and have that true, authentic student experience. So yes, it's something that is very stressful for us to look at the liability and the cost of keeping those halls of residence open.
And I just wanted to add at the end that the universities that the OFS seems to be seeing as in financial risk are not just the universities you might expect. There's a couple of graphs later in the report where you see in every tariff group, in every university type, there are there are examples of universities that are at risk in terms of liquidity, and that if we're just saying, oh, it's certain kinds of universities, or if a minister in DfE lazily thinks, oh, it's just the bad universities, however you cut the sector, it's not, it's everybody. So the sector really has to pull together on this.
Now, DK was in Birmingham for DigiFest this week and caught up with colleagues there.
So I'm here in Birmingham at DigiFest with Heidi Fraser-Krause, the Chief Executive of JISC. Heidi, how does it feel to be all back together again?
Absolutely marvellous. It's just been great, the energy in the room, people been able to speak to each other, share ideas, people who've never met each other.
Yeah.
You know, so you see somebody and you've only ever seen them on Zoom, and all of a sudden you realise they're 5'7" or 6'7". It's been really good.
I think it's been like that for a lot of people.
Indeed.
What, I mean, what kind of conversations have been going on at DigiFest? I mean, what are people talking about as they get back together?
So challenges around how you make hybrid work.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a real challenge for everybody, whether that's office working or whether that's teaching and learning, how you get that to work. What does work?
Of course.
The other interesting thing. So I said in my opening address, you know, we've had a 2-year experiment in some ways of using technology in ways that we haven't used it before. Some things work really well, some things don't. And I think that is a conversation that's been going on as well.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, JISC, in its role as a central provider of services, but also as, I think it's fair to say, one of the instigators of the online learning capacity that exists in the UK system, just be the big part of that. So what's the big priorities for JISC in the next year or so? What kind of things are you up to?
So the thing that I'm being asked for more and more is advice and guidance. What's best practice? How do we do this well? Cyber is another big thing.
Of course, you
will not be surprised to hear that everybody's really keen on making sure that the things, you know, we've relied on digital entirely, you know, making sure that universities are cyber secure, whatever term, I mean, I don't even know what words to use on that, but making sure people are as secure as possible. Developing connectivity further. That's something, you know, there are lots of innovations out there. The 5G is coming down the track. Quantum, if you look a bit further down. So we've got all of these plans around looking at the Janet network and connectivity for institutions. Because, again, that's the other thing that's been absolutely paramount, isn't it?
Absolutely, it has.
And now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? And here to set this week's correlation question is Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan.
Welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate? The podcast segment that is a sector-recognised standard. The sector has shifted in size and shape over the past 7 years, with subject areas and thus academic staff numbers growing and shrinking according to the demands of applicants and what the market will bear. Or has it? I've plotted the number of academic staff in each cost centre, which is broadly the same as each subject area, in 2014-15 and 2020-21. A correlation here would mean that subject areas have all grown at the same rate, and an absence of a correlation would mean that some subjects have grown while others have shrunk. So, does it correlate?
No, it doesn't. No, there's too much variability. No, it's all over the place.
I would say no.
The answer here surprised me quite a lot. R squared is 0.98, a very, very strong correlation. This does hide some interesting movements, though. For instance, the number of academics in health and community studies has fallen between 2014-15 and 2020-21. The graph on the podcast page offers a range of filters to give us some further insights. We learned, for example, that computer science has seen the largest growth in academics under 25 years old over this period, and that there are more academic staff in business studies over 66 years old than in any other subject area. The data is from the HESA staff collection, and where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
Now, Universities UK is out with a new admissions code. Laura, what jumped out at you?
Well, I think this is very overdue, to be honest. So the UUK has launched a new Fair Admissions Code of Practice. It's a set of self-regulatory principles. And this is going to be developed in consultation with applicants, school leaders, and sort of the admissions team. So the code is going to be referenced in the UK admissions principles. And the reason I say it's long overdue, because often these conditional offers can feel like a dodgy phone contract in that you're locked in and unable to even think about going elsewhere. And so I think it's good that there's an increasing interest in this area, and guild members will also become signatories on the practice.
So, Paul, I mean, you've written a lot about this issue in the past, haven't you? I guess one of the big things that's shifted is the government dropping its commitment to PQA or PQO. I mean, does this sort of do something in the middle?
No, not really. I don't think. I mean, I think it's a not unhelpful guide, and I think it's one that universities should find no difficulty in signing up to, and it's straightforward, and it you know sets out what we should do and the rules that, by which we should all play, and I think that's absolutely fine. I mean, it does seem a slightly elaborate way to ensure that we won't, you know, we all agree that we're not going to do conditional, unconditional offers again. I mean, I have to say, I think that's something that's, you know, that's gone now, with the exception of one university. You know, it would be easier just to focus on that and say, no, agree, we'll never do it. But anyway, we've got a load of extra stuff here, which is pretty straightforward. I am disappointed about the PQA issue. I mean, you know, I always resented it being, you know, the suggestion that somehow government was going to impose it on us and they were going to tell us how to do it is one of the former Secretary of State's great initiatives, for which he has thankfully been richly rewarded with a knighthood. To be told what to do in admissions is always an irritant for universities. But nevertheless, I think from my point of view, it's still the right thing to do. However, it's dead in the water now. I still think universities have it within them to decide that they want to do it in, you know, 5, 6, 10 years time, wherever it might be. And it would be a rational alternative to where we are now. However, I'm in a minority of roughly 2 or 3 on that in the entire sector. And therefore, I'm going to shut up about it now.
Thank you, Paul. From my perspective, just looking through this iteration of the Code of Practice, it's not really changed substantially from other iterations. We're still dealing, aside from the conditional, unconditional stuff, which we've talked about, we're still dealing with broadly the same issues as we were dealing with in the old days when agencies like the Supporting Professional Admissions, or SPAR, walked the earth, and we did take admissions practice seriously as a thing in its own right. As is probably clear to everybody, I'm pleased that we didn't go down the road of PQA and PQO. But the stasis in admissions, I think it doesn't help the sector. There is a sense in which the system has become ossified, and that when we face the real changes in 2025 with modular admissions and modular applications as a part of the lifelong loan entitlement and associated measures, universities are going to have to move very quickly to consider and understand new ways of managing admissions. It does feel like, although there's been a number of iterations of this particular code before, this is probably the last iteration that is going to look like this. And even if we're sitting in here, you know, in 4 or 5 years' time, rather than considering PQA or PQO for what feels like the 28th time since the turn of the century, we will in fact be looking at other issues and other measures.
I guess a lot probably depends on what happens in this application cycle. So we've had obviously very uneven the last couple of years because of the pandemic, or you could say the policy decisions that came out of the pandemic. I guess, is there a risk that the issue starts rocketing back up the kind of wider news and political agenda? And I guess is the question about conditionals or not start to become political again?
So the thing about I should just briefly pick up Paul on a thing he said. He said that there was one university that was still doing conditional unconditionals in a year that they were banned from doing so. The fact that the Office for Students hasn't come charging onto that particular campus in their special compliance car is that that was actually a data submission error, and there were actually no conditional unconditional offers in 2021. I think that I'll let you come in a second, Paul. I think that you've actually made me completely forget what I was going to say, so you might as well come in now. Sorry.
I didn't know that, Dickie. I was just I was just expressing surprise at that news because I wasn't aware of it. I'd picked it up in news. I hadn't picked up that it was a data error. I was expressing surprise.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Well, I think that we've all learned if it's not being covered in wonky, it's not a thing. If it relates to data, and I think that's a sensible definition to go forward. In terms of the political pressure on university admissions, arguably the pressure in the last couple of years was not on admissions as a process in itself. It was on level 3 qualifications and level 3 attainment, and understanding the way that reflects on the potential of somebody to go forward and succeed in higher education. Obviously, with the interest in the threshold, that's going to put even more pressure on level 3. God forbid we have another round of COVID with everything else that's going on as well, but the severe pressure that a threshold that would mean that a person could or could not go to university would place on a teacher awarding a grade. This is a decision that will profoundly affect somebody's life course. That's going to put some pressure on level 3. I think in this country, we're long overdue a proper look at qualifications at level 3 and level 2. We specialise far too early. We focus on high stakes exams to the detriment of all other forms of understanding and supporting learning. We're starting to see movement on this in Scotland. They're going back to the Curriculum for Excellence, and that kind of thinking about a wider experience of compulsory education. I do hope eventually that we'll start thinking about that in England and maybe end up actually abolishing A-level, something which is long overdue.
Completely agree with that. Can I just kind of comment, follow up that? Because I think that, you know, pending that longer-term structural change compulsory education, I do think the issue for institutions is about having an approach to admissions and the whole process, which is both as predictable in a very turbulent environment as it can be, but also, you know, ensures that everyone plays by the rules and that students are not and applicants are treated fairly and equitably across the system. And that's what part of what this is intended to achieve. Because what we don't want to do is to see universities going maverick, coming up with their own rules, breaking all the rules, and ruining it for everyone. This is where it's in everyone's interest that everyone plays by the rules.
The welfare of students and the mental stress that these offers can create sometimes, especially when they have time-sensitive, unconditional offers where you have to accept within a certain time. I think that's wrong. I think students are already under enough pressure and we need to just ease off a little bit, and making sure that every institution is singing to the same song sheet is absolutely necessary.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on at UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our various subscriptions. So thanks very much to Paul, Laura, DK and everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. Until next week, stay wonky.